Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
I felt unheard, right, when they said, you're so lucky. Your alcoholism didn't get real bad.
Nobody feels unlucky when they're walking through the door, typically.
So the Plain Language Big Book is written for people who need the message in their own native tongue. And Bill Wilson's flowery language isn't it, right? You know, because it's just word salad to a lot of people.
Do you start by saying, hey, buddy, listen up?
I want the Tom language big book. Yeah.
That's how it works starts. Hey, buddy, listen up.
Hey, listen.
You know, what I really appreciated the other night is so the How It Works was pamphlet or the How It Works, you know, the sides were passed out at the meeting for the different people to read. And my grand sponsor is a novelist. And he's somebody that I very much revere, I look up to. And he was just taking the piss out of this thing, you know, as he was reading it, just kind of like, look at this plain language version of the. And then he gets to the end and he's like, not bad, actually. That's pretty well written, you know. And if you really like look at, if you try to, you know, approach it with an open mind, you know, I think it's probably a good idea.
When I hear from people who work in prisons, they're in tears at how much this book has helped people sort of connect with what we're trying to tell them.
Good morning, Tom. I was just telling Joe about the fires here in LA, or I shouldn't even say here. See, I'm in Joshua Tree now. I haven't been here for like more than a month, and I thought that I could benefit from some time away from the city. And then just as I leave, you know, the Eye of Sauron ignites, and it's just like the images I'm getting from there are terrible. And I've got to figure out, I've been looking at, like, there's this app that you can get, and I'm trying to figure out how to use the app. And maybe the winds are blowing the fire to where I'm at, but there's the freeways that I would need to use to traverse from here to there if I were to want to do that. I mean, everybody is in a state of panic.
Well, where Tom lives, the roads are freezing probably.
Mm-hmm. Really?
One of my Canadian clients, I was talking to her one day, maybe last year or something like that. And I go, she came in and she says, I said, oh, how cold is it there? She goes, it's below, it's 23 below. I'm going like, fuck, I'm cold here. And, you know, I mean, from her 23 below, it was like I was freezing just because she said it. It's but she said it so matter of fact. It's like 23 below.
Post-traumatic gains. And I, when you sent this, it actually reminded me, I saw a clip of Steve-O from Jackass semi-recently. And he was talking about this dynamic where, unlike other illnesses where you can only ever hope to come back to a level of health that you were experiencing, you know, at the time the illness first fell on you, what is interesting and unique about, you know, alcoholism, trauma, you know, some of these other maladies, you know, that we face, is that there's a Dorian Gray effect. You know, you can actually like come back, you know, you physically, emotionally, you know, intellectually, to where, yeah, I mean, you're far improved from where you were even before things started to snowball with the addiction.
Well, even to the point of where, you know, I mean, one thing that I used to say, you know, and that's why I love emotional sobriety. I used to say, what do people do who aren't addicts? I mean, you know, because it occurred to me, you know, several years into this that everything I was learning that was of any value was because I'd fucked up so badly. You know, and it's like, I mean, and I was going like, well, so if you're not an alcoholic, what do you, you know, where do you get this stuff? And I know there are places you can do that, but it's like, you know, to me, I bet most of the people we know are, that's the norm for us, right? But Patrick, is that the idea that we do grow beyond, you know, it's like, you know, and I mean, to the point where, I mean, I remember I heard first time I heard somebody say in a meeting when I was first in the program, I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. Now you talk about a novelist who was doing editing, English major here. I was going, oh, he misspoke in my head. He meant to say he was grateful to be recovering from his alcoholism, but he said he's actually. And then I don't know, a while later I heard somebody else say it, And I was going like, what the fuck? It's like, you know, and then the punchline of this is the short version is, and then down the line, I heard me say it, you know, and I, you know, and he's, and I don't know if I knew when it happened, when I had the insight, but it's just like, you know, how else would I have done what I've done, known what I've known, be who I am, you know? And I'm sure there are other, I don't understand the universe. I'm sure there are other ways, but this was a good one.
I'll just say I eventually said it too. Yeah. I caught the bug.
But the first time you hear it, it's weird.
There are people who in their 70s are healthier than they were in their 40s, right? Because they just sort of learned about, you know, that lifestyle informs your quality of life, right? So they adjusted their lifestyle to suit the realities of their humanity, and they seem to be fighting inevitability and winning. I thought it was hyperbole when I first heard, I'm happy to be an alcoholic, right? I go, man, you have either lowered your expectations or...
the lowering of expectations.
Yeah, what are you tripping on? And until one experiences it, and this isn't to say this is a universal experience. Of course, some people face trauma, face addiction, and live with the malady of that. They have to work their whole life around, they do have to lower their expectations, live within new limits. But for many people, we can see this. They are better ahead, you know, financially, they are better ahead relationship-wise, they are better ahead meaning in life-wise than at their very best before addiction took hold. And I think emotional sobriety informs that. I don't think it's a lottery, and some people will and some people won't. I think, you know, like Recovery Capital comes into mind, but the book about emotional sobriety that Alan wrote talks about getting unstuck, right? And so that's that sort of divide in the road where people either stay stuck or they start to thrive. They start to get excited. They start to, embrace their life as an addict in recovery. And even when, like, let's say I've done that, still every day is a game of equilibrium, right? You know, I can be as, you know, depressed and negative as I was when I first came in, right? Like, I can get there and then I have to sort of come back again. But what are the things that inform whether someone's going to be living with the discomfort of addiction or trauma and just expecting less versus someone else who went through a similarly, like almost identical experience, but they are on top of the world. They couldn't have been where they were if they hadn't sort of faced those demons, and it was transformative to a point where it's like winning the lottery.
My editor at HarperCollins, he said if it wasn't for him, he said I would have begun every paragraph with the following paragraph may or may not apply to you, you know, because I was stopping to disclaim all the time because I didn't want people to think I was telling them, you know, I know this about you. And it's like he said, you know, we'll do a disclaimer in the front of the book. Was a little, he said, well, and I have learned to do that. But this thing what you talked about me putting off the looking at the trauma. It's like, I mean, it, you know, we're all on that continuum somewhere, but I'm thinking right now about people who just some serious, I think the clinical term is serious ass trauma. And it's like, I'm thinking about a client of mine that I started working with several years ago and for eating disorder. And she told me one of the sessions, as a, by the way, she said, by the way, you probably should know that I had some sexual abuse in my childhood, you know, but I I did therapy and I've taken care of that. It's like, that was years ago. And it's exactly what you just said, Patrick. I mean, she opened the door that day and she got to a place that where, I mean, it's one of the, it's hard. You got to volunteer for pain to do this. You know,
you got to give something for that.
This is going to hurt like hell. Okay. But is it then going to feel better? It's like, eventually, probably it's like, I just have so much respect for, some shit happened to me, but I mean, when I talk about this woman had been raped and abused and sexually molested and mistreated and disrespected her entire life. And she had a beautiful defense system. You know, she's a successful teacher. She's going through life. She was, doing well in life. It's like she's smart as can be because she's doing her eating disorder treatment. And get this, she decided to stop drinking. She volunteered for alcohol recovery. I mean, I don't understand those people. It's like, come on. It's like, where's your denial system? But it's like, so she hasn't had a drink for probably 4 years. And what does that do with all this trauma stuff? It makes it harder, and she's doing everything she's a perfect example of the thing where you say, how are you doing? And the response is, are you asking me how I'm doing or how I'm feeling? Because they're not the same thing most of the time. Very often when I'm doing good, when I'm doing well, I feel like shit because I'm hip deep in this work.
Well, what I'll add to that is, pulling back a little bit from, the most intense of traumas. I think just like the dynamic of change in our lives, and whether we are trying to flow with the wave or whether we're kind of standing obstinately against it, meaning, are we in sobriety or in a layer of sobriety that we've reached? Are we still staying in the job that we hate? Are we still, are we deciding to work on the marriage or to not work on the marriage? The more, I guess you might call them banal, aspects of our lives, there's definitely like bridges that I need to cross. And I guess, being aware that I need to cross them, that's the first step towards change. But, my recovery won't continue if I'm not being more courageous, I guess, in my life and kind of meeting the challenges when they arise.
Joe used the word fluid earlier, and it just caught my attention. And you just described being in the flow, basically, of the things. I remember the first time I ever whitewater rafted, and the guy, 19-year-old kid taught me, he said, when you fall out in a rapid, he said, don't swim. Don't try to stand up. He went through that whole process. The punctuation was, he said, that rapid will spit you out on the other side. If you just do that. And it's like, but I think what you're describing, Patrick, is that, and I think it's the beautiful way to think about all of our recovery. I hope I get in that river, that flow, every day of my life until the day I'm not alive, and I think we can do a lot of good helping people understand, we have the cliches, but it's like, no, it's really not a destination. It really is a process. It's really, what Alan and I always say, it's a practice. It's a daily practice, and that's learning that thing has made all the difference in the world in my recovery for sure. Hi, Alan.
Hey, guys. Happy New Year. Happy New Year. It's interesting, Joe, that you brought this topic up. The American Psychological Association publishes a monthly journal called The American Psychologist. And this last month's journal was devoted to post-traumatic growth completely. Every article in the publication was addressing this whole issue and trying to understand it and to really to really see if there are some themes that stand out to help us understand this more. And, you know, the American Psychologist is for both clinicians and researchers. So they're also looking at trying to operationalize the definition for research and all of that other stuff. But I think it's important for our discussion to understand what trauma does. Because when we're talking about post-trauma, you know, we're talking about, first of all, what happens? How does a person deal with the experience of being traumatized? And what we know, without a doubt, that when you're traumatized, you lose a part of yourself. See, that's a very important concept to keep in mind. Alice Miller, who did a lot of work on child rearing and what she called toxic child pedagogy, right, which is, you know, toxic child development, which is, you know, beating the child and shaming the child, emotional and physical abuse. She says one of the greatest losses that a child suffers is their exuberance for life. I mean, think about that for a minute. That's such a powerful, powerful statement, is that the child loses their zest for life. And instead of being excited and passionate and filled with curiosity, that child's world shrinks to try to be safe, right? To try to ensure, you know, and to, you know, salvage as much of themselves as they can from a situation that is just fracturing them terribly, both physically and emotionally and psychologically. So when we talk about post-traumatic gains, you know, what we're talking about is what has to happen for us to recover those parts of ourselves that are lost. Now, it's very interesting that not a lot of people have talked about it this way, but we can think of alcoholism as self-trauma. You know, think about it. I mean, not a lot of people have described it that way, but I think that it would be worthwhile for us to consider that we are traumatizing ourselves when we're in the throes of our disease. Because we talk about, what do we lose, right? In trauma, we lose a part of ourselves. Well, I don't know about you guys, but I became 180 degrees opposite of who I was in my disease. I became a liar, a thief, no integrity, manipulative. I mean, self-centered to the.
Well, that's why the Jekyll and Hyde metaphor works so well, because so many of us have that exact experience. I encourage most of my addict clients to read the Robert Louis Stevenson novel, because it's not the same as the TV thing we've seen. It's like it's really a story of addiction, and it is the split you just described. It is self-harm. Addiction is, and it's what we're doing, among other things, in the bigger picture. You just described it, Alan. We're violating our own value system every single day of our lives, and that not only hurts, that harms us.
I mean, how many of us begin recovery, and even in recovery, are still filled with shame?
The first Alice Miller book that was referred to me by a therapist was Thou Shall Not Be Aware, right? And then later, Drama of the Gifted Child. And yeah, like I was not aware. I was sleepwalking, to use emotional sobriety language, right? I was just reacting and responding to all of this buildup without understanding its mechanics or seeing that I was living a provisional life, not a self-asserted life, right? And that was a real eye-opener for me.
Thou shalt not be aware, right? That's another one of another thing that we lose, you know, right? So our awareness, our value, you know, we compromise our value system. Our integrity is at an all-time low, right? At a nadir. I mean, this is also a self-inflicted trauma. Now, some people say, well, it's self-inflicted, so it's not the same. Well, I don't know. You know, you're still experiencing a loss, you know, whether it's somebody else doing it or doing it to ourselves. Now, I think that what, you know, I know as a psychotherapist, if I'm traumatizing myself, it means I've been also traumatized.
Right. It didn't start. Yeah. And when you said that, yeah, I get people do that, but I go like, you need to look a little closer for the colors because there's a lot of gray in there, you know, a whole lot. It's like, people really make the mistake of not distinguishing between responsibility and blame. And, you know, and my simplest version is blame is an anchor that goes down in the sand and stops us. And responsibility, that's the sails that take us forward. And responsibility has nothing to do with letting ourselves off the hook. It's everything about putting ourselves on the appropriate hooks, you know. But go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I was just reading that part of the self-forgiveness handbook. So,
in there?
That's great. It is. Yeah, that's where you got your anchor analogy.
Yeah, you're quoting the famous Tom Rutledge. Yeah.
You know, you guys have bound to have done this too, but I mean, it's like, I had a guy send me a thing one time, you know, on Facebook, and it was beautiful. I loved it. It's called What is Strength? And I wrote him back and said, who wrote this? And could I borrow it? And he wrote back and said, you wrote it, and you're the one that gave it to me. It's like, and I thought, and I still thought, this is you guys will get this. The great thing was, I still thought it was beautiful. I didn't turn on it as soon as I knew I was the author.
Well, Alan, I wanted to just respond to something you said. So when it comes to like losing your zest for childhood, you know, or like that moment when, you know, the child ceases to become a child. And so I suppose then the post-traumatic gain, you would need to find a way to revert back to like a far earlier date than like maybe somebody like me is thinking about. And, you know, I just remember for whatever reason when you were talking about that. When I was a kid, I used to just get like insanely bent out of shape when my mom would try to cut my hair. I used to get tags on the insides of my shirts, you know, just a little bit of itch on the inside of my shirt. And I would just like panic, like I wouldn't be able to wear the shirt. I had this thing with like little kid blue jeans. Like I could only wear the only like fabric that I wanted to touch my skin was like sweatpants, you know, when I would go to kindergarten and stuff. And on top of that, I was just like as sensitive as could be, like some other like mean kid said a mildly, you know, bullying thing to me. And I would just, you know, be in a tizzy. And I don't know, I just, for whatever reason, it just clicked for me. I was thinking about that. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I was like a prime target for alcoholism. Like that lightning bolt was going to hit me at some point just because I was a, you know, soft boy. And that's, you know. It's all ties in, I suppose, to the journey.
Yeah, I was thinking that what you were describing, Patrick, is what people are talking about is being highly sensitive. And if you're not helped to cope with that, then it becomes a real issue in life. But, you know, when you say it's going back, see, that's a myth. It's a misnomer. You can never go back. You're never going to be able that child again, because your consciousness is different today. So it's not about going back, it's about what going forward looks like. You know, even that part of us is influenced, you know, our memory is influenced by who we are and how we think about things now, right? So it's, you're never going to go back to that. And it's not about going back to that, it's discovering what it means today to be in touch with all of you. See, and to be able to integrate that. And if we use the past as a baseline, we may be cutting ourselves short. We may be doing ourselves a disservice, because you're not going to be that. You know, you're kind of like people idealize medieval times. They think, oh my God, there was such a, well, listen, the castles were cold. They didn't have central heating. I'm not so sure I want to be back in the medieval days. I mean, my God, you know, come on. It's like you lived until you were, what, about 35 years old or something like that, 39 years old, the average. It's very important to not idealize the past and what could have been. Like, I love when Tom brought it into our discussion. It's not just about I'm okay if. I'd be okay if this didn't happen to me. And see, that's the consciousness that we want to turn around. Just like when you hear people go to meetings and you hear people say, well, I'm a grateful alcoholic. well, how can you be grateful to have a disease that was so damaging and harmful to not only yourself, but all the people you love? Because there's a process that we go through to turn that around, to convert that into something we can be grateful for, because it serves us and serves the people we care about. So that's the one thing. We don't want to go back. We want to go forward. We want to gain wisdom from the experience. See, that's the critical point here, is that when people are able to have post-traumatic gain that you're talking about, Joe, is what that means is they become wiser at this point in time. They'll still have a wound, and that wound will still be a part of their life. It won't control them as much as it did before they do the work they have. The wound will never be completely gone, but it will be healed in some ways. It'll still inform people, but it'll inform them, and they will deal with that with a sense, with wisdom, right? With a different sense of what it all means and in terms of how to cope with it. See, so that becomes the important thing, is that gain is wisdom. That's what we're looking at here. And what does it take to gain wisdom from a painful, traumatic experience? Now, interesting thing, when I read this whole very thick American psychologist, because there's a lot of people talking about this because it's such an important topic. You know, one of the things that one of the articles was the importance of the people, the community, and the family that's around us as we're doing the work. And what they found is that those people that had people that would encourage, join, participate, witness, be an enlightened witness to the process, did better than those people that were in a situation, just like we found in recovery. People do better when the whole family's involved in recovery than when a person just gets, you know, goes into recovery themselves and the family never gets involved. Doesn't mean somebody can't get well by themselves, they can. But the quality of it is so much better when we're in a situation and a climate that's supporting the work we're doing. And look, we see that on Thursday night, don't we, Tom? In terms of the community that's being developed with people doing this work on emotional sobriety, is that people love coming to that because they are being encouraged to grow themselves in a community that's supporting that work.
Some people call it recovery capital. People in addiction medicine, what we see is that they're creating this whole language called recovery ready workplaces, just to create that environment you were talking about, Alan, that, you know, that favors and rewards and supports recovery, as opposed to making it an obstacle to entertaining clients, right, you know, or whatever. But you know, imagine a recovery ready bar, right? It would probably have a whole host of great drinks that was, you know, that were, you know, sober drinks, right? You know, so this idea of community, of course, time speaks to this, you know, connection is the number one thing. And it was what AA understood right from the beginning. What we learned from the history of writing the big book, just to speak to AA, was Bill Wilson came to a point where he thought he'd finished writing the book before he'd written the steps, right? He described the dilemma of addiction, of how it's powerless, the need for transformation, be it, you know, supernatural. And even when you have that, you need to work with others, because that won't sustain you inevitably, right? You know, he'd had his white light experience, but he was thirsty in an Akron bar, and only talking to another alcoholic would have kept him through. And so he talked about the fellowship, and he'd written about the, you know, understanding alcoholism. He wrote about the transformative, you know, experience. And then he wrote about working with others. And A Vision for You was all about a fellowship. And that was all written before chapter what we now know as 5 and 6, the sort of step ones. And we've sort of, we kneel at the altar of the steps, but his whole concept had been conceived when it was just that supportive community you were just talking about, Alan. That's all there was, right? You know, and of course people changed what they did, but not necessarily in a uniformed way.
Well, it's so easy to forget, no matter how many times I prove this to myself, like sharing whatever it is, the struggle that I'm going through, that doesn't mean, consult the community for like a solution, quote unquote, to whatever the problem is.
I've had that with sponsees. They'll say, I love talking to you. And I'll realize I didn't say anything, but you don't say, you know, how do you mean? Are you sure about that? That's all I've done. My closing thoughts, because I know Tom's on the clock here, are you asked the question, can anybody do it alone? And I've heard the argument that nobody recovers alone. Now, they might not be extroverted and join a group and be holding hands with everybody all of the time. It might be a small group of enablers or helpers. But I'm trying to think of an exception to nobody does it alone. And, you know, there's got to be some sort of support, someone to hold our hand through it. I know that's definitely the case. Now, we were talking about getting too introverted, you know, and it's a yes and thing, right? Yes, I've got to do the internal work and I've got to engage in community. My ancestors treated, you know, the story of America and Canada is pretty much the same, right? There were people here before we got here. Unfortunately, my ancestors treated them like savages and weren't curious about their ways. And their ways not only regarded community as important, but the environment as important. And that sort of takes us back to our pre-podcast discussion about the world on fire and freezing over. That's just from losing those great, kernels of wisdom that not only North American indigenous societies embrace, but you look at all of the, 3,000 or longer old societies and they understand that too.
And an excess of individualism throws the entire universe into disharmony. That's what it looks like to me.
Yeah, it's got to be a balance.
Tend your life, tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you